loved them less, but I was the girl. So that That's whole right. resiliency message that you're special mm-hmm. really does shape folks to believe and start seeking out other people who believe they're special. That's one of my advantages. I had children at 17, 18, 19, 22, and lived, my ex-husband had a seventh grade education, not literate. And so we lived our entire marriage the same way I had grown up. Mm-hmm. We slept in cherry fields. We slept in a laundry room. But in that pilot program through Mount Hood, I finally found navigators or people who were willing to get to know me, mm-hmm. to see what was important to me, which was my kids. Mm-hmm. And then to frame stepping forward from, you're going to be able to help your kids. Mm-hmm. So those times when I had to step outside of my comfort zone, like going to get the GED or beginning the associate's degree, they were there for me. And there were tears, and it was scary. It's very scary to step outside of everything you know without a guide, without someone to navigate for you. And that's why we've built into the Poverty Bridge model navigators mm-hmm. to come to the conference in the afternoon. And they're just citizens, just uh-huh. people who say, you know what? I'll give my phone number to somebody in the opportunity conference, and I will call them and check in and say, hey, how's it going? Mm-hmm. Is there anything standing in your way? Mm-hmm. And we can talk it through. And if it's in my hands to make a difference, I'll do it. And if it's not in my hands, hey, I've got a network.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And I'll look into my network. And the other thing, you know, we have a lot of attorneys who are volunteering to be navigators. Mm-hmm. And one of their things was, we don't know much about social service. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the human service folks are saying, we don't know much about business.
Right, that's right.
And what I'm saying is, you know how to know.
That's right.
You
that's
know
right.
how to ask the questions. Mm-hmm. And that is something that when you're in that isolated world of poverty, you don't even know what questions you can ask
that's
often.
Right. That's right. That's
and you get true. The computer, or you get the bureaucratic system that mm-hmm. you can't get through. So this is really an opportunity for folks to use their titles, mm-hmm. and we're a nation of titles.
Yes.
I tell people I don't use my title of Dr. Beagle mm-hmm. unless you mess with people who have no voice.
That's right.
And then I become, this is Dr. Beagle, I'd like to speak to a supervisor, please.
Exactly. We are talking to Donna Beagle, who is CEO and founder of Poverty Bridge, and it is a program that is set up to provide supports for people living in poverty to help them move and navigate through the system so that they can become self-sufficient and support themselves and their family. If you want to join us in this conversation, pick up the phone and give us a call at 503-231-8187. Dave, do you have a question?
Well, I was going to. Thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome.
I was going to ask because, you know, obviously, I mean, one of the core parts of this is to help people navigate and hopefully take the same, you know, get on a course similar to what you did. And part of that involves being able to work your way through whatever services are available out there to help you break down these barriers. And I'm wondering, how has the landscape changed in terms of services available from when you had your experience? Are the folks facing much higher barriers and obstacles? Is there less resources available?
Well, I think we have to think about resources in a different way. I mean, we've spent, that I know of, 20 years talking about collaboration mm-hmm. and bringing all the toys into the sandbox, and yet still we have this organization working over here and this organization working over here and this organization working over here. And Poverty Bridge really does work to bring all of the vested stakeholders who want to make a difference, whose job it is to make a difference, to the table to say, okay, what can you do? What can you do? What can mm-hmm. you do? The human capital has yet to be tapped into. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what we're bringing as well. So I think as you think about resources, I do a little quiz in my training and ask these questions. How much do you think we spent on Hannah Montana Disney princess merchandise and High School Musical merchandise last right, year. Right. Does anyone know?
Right.
Yeah. Other than too much is the only answer yeah. I can come up with.
Right. The answer would be $26
billion. Oh, my goodness.
We spent $33 billion on pet toys and supplies. Mm. And if you combine those two numbers, you have enough to provide child health care for all children in America for 5 years.
That's right.
We're spending $1.6 billion on prisons in Oregon this year.
That's right.
80% of the people in prison can't read at eighth grade level.
That's right.
One scholar said, if we continue to incarcerate America's poor, we won't have to have conversations about affordable housing and living wage jobs.
No, we won't, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, if we don't improve our education system, we will continue to be the pipeline from the education system into the prison system. We have a caller on the line. Good morning, Glenda. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, there were actually two things that struck my mind with the conversation that's going on. I don't know quite which one to talk about. Something, an idea that occurred to me with my two foster sons who are Hispanic and come from a long history of poverty, and that was to tell them that if they save $10 a week, they'll be able to, I have two brothers, they'll be able to buy a house together when they're in college, and they'll completely escape the cycle of poverty because they'll have the down payment on a house, and that whole idea just excites them and makes them feel empowered to have a different life than...
How fabulous that is.
That's a wonderful incentive. You know, just those when you use incentives that make sense and that are relevant, and that's what I say to kids. How'd you like to buy your mom a house?
Mm-hmm.
How'd you like to never see your grandma evicted again?
That's right.
Here's how you could do it. You got to get that education. You got to get a skill.
Right.
We have a labor market that requires that.
That's right. And what was your second, one that you were debating against?
Yeah, I volunteer with an agency that serves people grieving, and I work with a group of moms who have been widowed,
right?
And they're Hispanic, they're Spanish-speaking, and they're having such struggles, you know, not only with dealing with the effects of grief, but the lack of a breadwinner, language limitations. And I was wondering, you know, if there might sometime be a conference offered bilingually or in Spanish or something like that, they could sure use some help. And it's very difficult for them to access services with a language barrier.
It's interesting because last year I was actually involved in a leadership program where we use simultaneous translation, and it is one of the most fabulous equipments that have ever been created because it gives everybody the opportunity to fully participate at the same time. I've also been in the other ones where there's translators with a group of people on the side, and that's very intimidating. It puts you behind the curb, and you really can't be a full participant. And so I agree with you that as often as we possibly can, we should be thinking about how we're able to really create a community that includes everybody in the community.
And we will have that, but the organizations that are sending folks, they are setting that up. So so Poverty Bridge, because it's a brand new baby nonprofit, we don't have the capacity, but the organizations that are working with us, they are providing that.
Well, you know, you could call me and I can tell you who has them and who will give them to you for free.
It's who you know.
That's right. It's not what you know, it's who, every day of the week. Thank you so much for your call, ma'am, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So, Donna, you know, one of the things that occurred to me is, of course, we're in this economic meltdown as a world, not just as the country, but as a world. And everybody's talking economic stimulus, but every single economic stimulus package I have heard, I do not see poor people, I don't see people of color, I don't see women included. Everybody keeps talking transportation, construction, you know, this is how we're going to put everybody back to work, as if there's like no acknowledgement that there's a whole group of people in our community that need skill training, that need education support, and need to be able to feed their families while they're going through that. And so you have any thoughts on like how disconnected our leaders are from what's really happening with people that are living in poverty?
Well, it's interesting when you use the word poverty. And I learned that during my studies at University of Portland for my bachelor's degree. I came into University of Portland believing that no one cared about people in poverty. And as I began meeting people who, in my opinion, were privileged, and I call privilege, you got a roof over your head, you got food in your fridge, you got health care, you got transportation, and you have adults in your life who've benefited from education and who've moved up in a job. That's my definition of privilege. And I met people, I started realizing, wow, they care, but they don't have a clue.
Right.
They don't have a clue what we're going through on a daily basis. So I started looking into, well, where are people learning about poverty?
Mm-hmm.
Is it K-12 curriculum?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-mm.
Right. The answer
not
is
there,
no.
Right.
Is it in higher ed? No. A matter of fact, we graduate people from college who become doctors, lawyers, judges, governors, president of the United States. They've never had Poverty 101.
Mm-hmm.
I ask audiences around this nation, raise your hand if you've had a course, History of Poverty, United States of America.
Nobody.
See, we don't know our history, but we can finish this sentence. If we don't know our history, we are
doomed to repeat it.
And that's what happens. So there is a great ignorance about poverty, and there's all these life experiences like generational poverty or working class poverty or immigrant poverty or situational. We have an epidemic of situational poverty right now, and that's those folks who are losing their homes with upside down mortgages. And that's a very different lived experience. In Poverty Bridge, we're addressing all of the different lived experiences. We don't screen folks. We're meeting people where they are, which is really how we have to address this issue.
That's right.
One of the government programs that I benefited from was a program called CETA. Some of you might remember that.
I do remember that.
Program.
I was 15 years old, and I got a summer job through CETA, and it was probably the most stability I had as a teenager. Problem was it ended when summer ended, which threw me right back into my same situation. But I think our politicians have to get in touch with the communities that they're serving, walk through them, hear people, go to the people. Look at Southeast Works. It's a model site for helping people who don't come from the traditional, I went to elementary, I went to middle, I went to high, I went to college, and now I'm working. It's a great program for meeting people where they are. There are folks there who are specializing in helping people get jobs who have felony records. We got to pay attention to this.
That's right.
Know people who are stealing to pay parole supervision fees.
That's right. Oh, it's insane. People get out of jail. We give them $50. We say, go get a place to live. Go get a job. Report to your parole and probation officer. And by the way, you have to pay for it. If you need alcohol and drug treatment, go get that. And by the way, you got to pay for it. And by the way, you owe back child support and et cetera, and court fines. And have a good day, right? And if you get in trouble, we're going to send you back to prison if you don't follow these rules. It's absolute insanity.
Well, 77% recidivism rate. You know what? Could you imagine a company where 77% of the product returned?
Right. Yeah. They wouldn't be in business long, would they? We are going to go back to the phone line. We've got several people that want to get in on this conversation. Good morning, Martha. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So the question that I really have is about how we frame the process that people need to go through to kind of rejoin or join for the first time the kind of economic abundance that we have in our society. And the word that we tend to use is self-sufficiency. And I just think it's kind of an unfair word, because what we know is that people who are succeeding, are thriving in our economy, are networked. They're not self-sufficient.
Right. That's
They're
right.
doing it with a whole set of incentives and assistance and friends, family, employers that help achieve that goal. So I guess my challenge is, can we reframe that? Can we come up with a new word to describe the process
that we're wanting
people to go through?
Well, you know, I teach there's no such thing as self-sufficiency. We're part of the human species, and we need each other. It's just that for some folks, that's built in. Your network of support is built in. Those folks who will open doors for you, who will guide you through what's possible. You know, a lot of folks want to blame the parents and say that's the cause of poverty. You know, my parents never attended a school conference. What do we say about parents like that?
Right, we say that they don't care. Right, they're not involved in their children's education.
We're so arrogant. We say they don't love their kids. Now, my mom would say, "I ain't going in there and make a fool out of myself." Those people want to talk about school. I don't know anything about school. What's the point of me going in there?
That's right.
Now, if an educator had said to her, "Tell me about Donna. What's she like?"
Right.
I feel sorry for that educator. She'd still be there talking. Pride and joy. She loves her kids.
That's right.
You know, I'm working a lot with courts around the nation to separate neglect from poverty. You know, there is a difference. And our foster care system is flooded with children from poverty because we don't know the difference. So
that's
I work
right.
with a lot of groups helping them separate neglect from poverty. But I think the notion of self-sufficiency, we have to call it. And we have to say, no one does it alone.
That's right. Well, and you know, I mean, government loves these little cutesy terms, you know, that they can define a program around. And it never is inclusive of all the people who need to experience whatever that government program is. And so, you know, we put nice little labels on it because it makes us more comfortable, right? It's like, if you fit into this box, we'll help you. If you don't fit into this box, sorry, you're on your own. And actually, I'm really glad we're having this conversation now because, of course, our legislature is in, and they are just passing an economic stimulus package. And it's making me crazy that our definition of who should be working in our community is so limited. And what we need is for regular folks, the folks that actually have jobs or, you know, have time to actually really be able to connect with their legislators now and say, well, wait a minute, what about the rest of the people, which is actually most of the people mm-hmm. that live in our state? What are we going to do for them? And when you see the governor presents a budget that slashes programs for the neediest people in our community and has the audacity to say, well, got to give up something in this budget, and I'm all about economic development and transportation infrastructure. I mean, that's appalling to me in a state that claims they care about people. Thank you for your call, ma'am.
Thank you.
Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm raising my own blood pressure. We have another caller on the line. Good. Hello, Marlene. Welcome to K-Boo.
Hey, how are you doing, Joanne?
I'm well, Marlene. How about you?
I'm okay, thank you. I'm okay. I'm just wanting to get some more information about this March 7th program, and I don't know if it's open to anybody else at this point or not, but I certainly know some people that might want to participate. So I was wondering if you could tell us about that. And I was also wondering, Donna, if your organization has a website yet, because I teach a class, and I teach a class in Portland State, and one of the things I do is I tell my students every week about organizations that are making a difference right along the issues of class in our community. And I'd like to tell them about you, but I always put up a website if I can. So I can take my answers off the air, but I would like to know if you have any of that kind of contact information.
Great Thanks. Questions. Thanks, Marlene.
Bye.
We do. The website is povertybridge.org. And you can find out on that website ways to volunteer. We have lots of need for volunteers. We have a great need for navigators right now. We have 71 navigators signed up for our March 7th conference, and we need 125. Mm. So, and again, these are folks who are just citizens who say, I'm willing to share my contact information. I'm willing to make the calls. I'm willing to try to help people to work through whatever barriers that they're facing to move forward. Now, I want to say that the slots for people who are in poverty to attend are full. But this is, again, our first opportunity conference and not our last. So if you're interested in volunteering, you can send an email on the website. There's a place you can click. And there's lots of opportunities to volunteer besides the navigator role. So we have a need for donations to help us putting this conference on. We're certainly not charging the people who are coming. Mm-hmm. So if you'd like to help us in that way, we'd appreciate that as well.
Wonderful. So let me take a moment and tell you what's coming up today on K-Boo. At 9 is Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell and the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, hear a pilot program of the director's chair. Southwest Concert speaks with Henry Sleckett, whose new film, Coraline, will be opening night program for the Portland International Film Festival. Also hear about the Cascade Festival of African Films. At 10 on the Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter hosts a dialogue on the pros and cons of eradicating invasive species with naturalist Stephen Hatfield and Lucille Bertucci. I'm messing up her name. I'm sorry, Lucille, but let's just say Lucille and her daughter Mary. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Ava Lake interviews Jesse Doris, who has a one-person show at 14:30. He'll talk about his new work exploring architectural forms. At 11, it's news and commentary on Air Cascadia with Chris Andrea and Liam Delta. At 11:15, hear Flashpoint with Dennis Bernstein. Today's show is part two of the three-part series, The Savaging of the Gaza Strip. That's what's coming up today on KBOO. And so, I guess we should go back to the phone line. Good morning, caller. Welcome to K-Boo.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a little bit about the politics of all this. You were kind of bringing some of that up a couple of minutes ago. And you said something kind of along the lines of, you know, we're talking about most people here. But I actually don't think it works that way politically. I think that, you know, it's sort of official poverty statistics in the country bounce around a little bit above or below 15%. If, you know, probably more than that if you really look at what people really need. But, you know, if you go, went back to the Great Depression, you had much higher levels of poverty, and even in the 20s, you know, before that, and a lot of people who weren't, were just coming out of poverty. Their families were just coming out of poverty. They were just, they were connected to it. So there were a lot of people who were connected to it and identified with it. And it seems to me like since the 50s in this country, or maybe you can date it later if you wanted, maybe the 70s, but you got this alliance that's been built up between people who consider themselves middle class and the wealthy people, and they sort of say, the hell with the poor people. And, you know, in fact, if you talk about poor people, you know, there's a stigma there, and there's a sort of flip side to the deficiency language that Dr. Beagle's been talking about, which is, you know, sort of pat ourselves on the back language for middle class people, however people define middle class. And somehow it's like, how do we get to a politics where, you know, we're not doing that to each other, and where we're connecting, you know, it may be that the economic hard times are going to start putting more people in fear of falling into poverty, and that'll change some of that dynamic. But anyway, so that's just sort of a question. I don't know if any of you have any thoughts about that.
Well, hang on. Donna's smiling at me, so I think she's got some response. And after she's done, I may have one or two.
Well, I think that, first off, we have to recognize that our federal poverty guideline is faulty.
Yes.
20,815 for a family of four. It's based on a 1960s cost of living formula where economists would take, they basically believed that people spent one third of their income on food, so they would multiply that by three. That's how they arrived at that federal poverty guideline. Mm-hmm. That's the same formula we use today. It does not include child care or transportation or health care as family expenses. Mm-hmm. So what you see is a lot of people who make $12 too much to qualify for Head Start, or a lot of people who can't get food stamps, and you know they need them.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the how can we, you know, looking at the Depression era, it was really a time when we said, we're all in this together. We need to help each other. So the sentiment wasn't that blaming, judging sentiment that you see today. However, we have to recognize that during the Depression era, there were class differences. There were people who had more education than others. There were people who had more land. There were people who had more connections. And when the Depression ended, what was really interesting in the literature is people turned around and who had more resources and said, the Depression's over. What's the matter with you?
That's right.
Because there was no recognition of those taken-for-granted advantages. Mm-hmm. I think that how we bring people together is through education. People need to know that in the 1700s in the Pennsylvania area, it was illegal to be poor.
Mm-hmm.
They made people
That's
wear right. a pea on their sleeve, mm-hmm. forced them when they left their homes to wear a 4-inch red or blue pea. A lot of our policy today is founded on that thinking of that time, which was if we can make it hard enough on people, if we can make it tough enough on people, they'll quit acting poor.
Mm-hmm. Dating back to the Elizabethan poorhouses in
right.
England.
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
And Herbert Gans, in his book, War on the Poor, he says, we keep asking people in poverty to act middle class.
Yeah, right.
And
right.
when they don't, we punish them.
Right, that's right.
So, I mean, how many of you are on time when you're in crisis?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what do we do our students living in crisis of mm-hmm. poverty?
That's right.
The other piece that I want to pick up on is the language we use to describe people who are living in that crisis condition. Mm-hmm. You will never hear me say the poor mm-hmm. because there's no people in it.
Mm-hmm.
I did an activity when I was teaching how language shapes our reality, and I asked grad students to say, what comes to your mind when you hear the words the homeless?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, don't think about it. Just tell me quickly.
Right.
And they said, dirty, lazy, drug addicts,
mm-hmm.
all the stereotypes.
Right.
And then I ask, what comes to your mind when I say people without homes? And they said, lost their jobs. They got sick.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, it was external. You could see the structural external causes.
Mm-hmm.
Poverty has structural causes. And it's not someone's personality. Now, we tend to wrap it into someone's personality because we do things like And maybe we take a Christmas basket to a family in poverty, and mm-hmm. we get there, and oh man, they got a big screen TV, and mm-hmm. they're watching cable, and they're mm-hmm. wearing Nikes, and mm-hmm. we don't understand that. Mm-hmm. And so when we don't understand as citizens, we judge. Mm-hmm. So what I do is I try to educate. Mm-hmm. What's behind that? So mm-hmm. think about that. I mean, Oprah Winfrey doesn't understand this. Mm-hmm. She said on her show, "I'd rather help children in Africa than children in America." Because she interviewed children in Africa, and she said, "What do you want?" And the kids said, "I want a uniform so I can go to school."
Right.
She interviewed kids in America and said, "What do you want?" And they said, "I want an iPod and a cell
phone."
That's
right. That's
and
right.
she said, "I don't want to help them."
Right.
But what she missed, Paulo Freire taught us so well in his work on poverty worldwide, every society teaches its people, what does it take to belong?
That's right.
In the United States of America, what do we teach people they
That's
need
right.
in order to belong?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm a kid and I walk into school with $100 Nikes on, what happens? People notice me. I get status. Maslow taught us those are elements of belonging.
That's right.
So belonging is right up there with eating for our species. People will do anything to belong.
That's right.
When I was on welfare and I had $408 to pay my rent of $395 on Southeast Duke, I would say to my daughter, go get your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll figure out a way to get by.
That's
or, you
right.
know, let's go down to Rent to Own and get one of those big screen TVs. Because
right.
maybe if we have what the people who are making it have, our lives will be a little better.
Mm-hmm.
But rest assured, folks, we don't get to keep it.
That's right. That's, it's only temporary. And, you know, I appreciate what you said, Donna. And I also wanted to, like, go back and give us a reality check about when the New Deal was created. When the New Deal was created, even though Roosevelt said that African-Americans, newly freed African-Americans should benefit from the New Deal, that was not so mm-hmm. in most parts of the country. And so even when the federal government talks about unemployment rate, they don't include African-Americans in those numbers. Because if you look deeper than with the 10% unemployment we have in Oregon, what you would find is that 25 to 30% of African-American males are unemployed. In any other society, we would be outraged. We would be appalled to think that that significant number of people are without jobs. And it doesn't even rate a headline in the newspapers here in our state. And so it certainly there certainly has a lot to do with who gets to frame the conversation, who gets to determine who's worthy and who isn't worthy of government support. That plays a lot into how we address these issues. And I absolutely agree. Language is very powerful.
Well,
and so
I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I didn't mean to be, you know, praising the new, you know, I mean, the labor laws were written to keep domestic workers and farm workers out. And
that's right.
You know, and you know, discouraged workers, people who aren't unemployed because they're not going down to the unemployment office because they're not, you know, they don't get anything out of it. They're still, they don't count. But,
that's right.
But I'm still the politics question is still mm-hmm. there. How do we overcome? How do we detach enough of the people who are identifying with the false moralistic messages that pull them upward in terms of, I don't know, their identity or in terms and their politics and who they vote for and what they vote for, you know, they so they'll support Kulongoski and the, you know, the male-oriented construction jobs, and they won't question about where we're going to get jobs for women who, you know, are on their own or
that's right.
two-income families, whatever. How do we change those politics is really the question.
Well, I can tell you my role is actually training low-income people to make that trip to Salem and go down and talk to their policymakers and put a face on this conversation so that they can't look us in the eyeball and say, well, we're providing jobs for everybody. Well, no, you're not, because the people that we're bringing down here are not people that have been included in your idea of economic stimulus.
Uh-huh.
So that's my role.
And I would just add to that, I just did a statewide poverty summit in Michigan, mm-hmm. and the governor spoke, and she said poverty 9 times. Mm. I was so happy.
Right.
Because you know what? When we name it, we right. have to act.
That's right.
And part of the issue is poverty is the huge elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. Martin Luther King said, if we're silent about race, there will be racism.
That's
the
right.
same is true about poverty. Mm-hmm. So part of it is educating people about real structural causes of poverty.
That's right.
You know, if a lot of people say, well, they're drug addicts, they're alcoholics. Let's really talk about some of those. I used to bring these huge stacks of celebrity magazines to my workshops,
mm-hmm.
and I would hold them up to my audience and say, look, this celebrity's an alcoholic. Look, this celebrity's a drug addict. I had one magazine with people with perfect teeth. Who,
right.
They were all celebrities who were addicted to drugs like meth
right.
and coke, and
mm-hmm.
and yet they had perfect teeth.
Right,
so,
right.
you know, what do we think when we see somebody with rotten teeth? We don't think, wow, I wonder if they've had nutrition to build strong, healthy teeth. Or,
that's right.
Wow, I wonder mm-hmm. if they've ever had dental care. We think, oh, they're drug addicts. You know, so our tendency to rely on the media as our educator for poverty,
yes,
it leads to dramatization,
that's right.
to extremes. And I think raising the awareness of, I'm really excited. I wrote it for 15 years. I've had people say to me, do you have a book? Do you have a book? I have a book now. It's called See Poverty, Be the Difference. And I'm very proud of it. It is an excellent resource guide. It has history. It has facts. It has best practices. It has activities that you can do as a citizen or a group mm-hmm. to really start to work toward that deeper understanding of poverty. And I think as people become aware,
mm-hmm.
you know, and introduced the fear,
mm-hmm.
You know, we've so dehumanized people in poverty, we don't even see them as part of our species. We say
right.
things like, why do they have babies?
Right.
Well, human beings have babies.
Right.
Just because you're poor doesn't mean you don't want to be part of your species.
That's right.
And it's a different thinking, too. When I had my kids at 17, 18, 19, and 22, I was thinking, I'm going to love them. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to play with them.
Mm-hmm.
We'll find a way to get by. That's the only lived experience I had. Now, I had kids at 38 and 39. I was working on my doctorate. My husband was a senior design engineer. He'd never had children. And he said to me, what do you think about having a child?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't think we can afford it.
Because
if you think about it, when right. middle-class folks talk about having children,
that's right.
the framing of it is, can we get them to college?
That's
do we
right.
live in the right neighborhood?
That's right.
You know, and really, truly, they say it takes from birth to 18 about $225,000
mm-hmm.
to raise a kid
mm-hmm.
in middle class. So if you're framing it that way,
right.
maybe an arm or something.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in poverty and all you've ever known is we find ways to get by,
that's right.
you know, you're going to think about it differently. And we're humans. We're just people.
You know, it occurs to me that I was at an economic summit over the weekend that I spoke at, and one of the challenges that I gave to the audience is we get to decide the new economy that we want to build. And we actually have the ability to build an economy that supports the people in that community, right? And we should not be sitting back waiting for our government to tell us what an economic stimulus package looks like. Instead, we should be going, because they're not visionary. They are not thinking outside the box. They're trying to do the same thing they've always done, and they actually expect different results, right? And so what we need to do is present them with a visionary proposal about the kind of economy that we want to build. I mean, we could create economies where you'd never have to have a dollar bill, where you use script, where you use trade, where you created a community and environment that supported the people in that community. And I'm disappointed that not on the state, at the federal level, no one is talking about what's an economy that works for real people, right? And let's figure out how to build that rather than putting back in place what didn't work.
That's right.
And
you
so,
know, Joanne, what the definition of continuing to do something that doesn't work?
Yes, insanity, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you so much for your call, sir. We've got many callers on the line, so we're going to move forward. Have a great day. Hello, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
Great show, and thank you.
Your
guest. This is a deeply important subject. That's repeating something over and over, expecting a different result is indeed insanity. Very, very briefly, stimulus. I'm tired of that word, the big stimulus package. It sounds almost pornographic. The words we really need to concentrate on, and I think we as a people are trying to, maybe if we contact these politicians, is reinvent, recover, and renew. So recovery, and renewal is what we're looking to do with this so-called stimulus package. And I'm struck that this maddening nature of this materialist nature of our media mad culture is creating, it is the enemy of poor people, as your guest pointed out, and education is the key. And very quickly, the wealthiest, most well-off amongst us are sometimes the poorest in spirit. And speaking of a paucity of truth, a real disaster there. I'm going to let my TV die, even though the Congress says I have till June now to either let it die or get the little box. But I want to pose this question to media generally, and a kind of flip side of Martin King's speech. It's not the the content of your character, but as to the media, it is the character of their content that is destroying the country, and that's what I all I could say. But we've got to throw away the word stimulus and really get recovery, reinvestment, and renewal in there.
Thank you.
Thanks
so
for taking my call.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. I want to read this small paragraph from Donna's book called See Poverty, Be the Difference, Discover the Missing Pieces for Helping People Move Out of Poverty. Donna says that internal barriers, the systemic barriers that people in poverty face, often manifest themselves in a deep lack of self-esteem and a strongly ingrained sense of despair. Faced with what they perceive as the impregnable barriers, people in poverty find no one to blame for their failures but themselves. Even if they verbally blame others to try to save face, they keep internalizing the poverty. What a profound statement that is, and it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's like and of course, the media actually reinforces that. Public agencies reinforces that, that if you're in poverty, there's no one to fault but you. And it's something you didn't do, there's a deficiency in your internal makeup. It's amazing that that was the first page I turned to, and that paragraph just jumped out at me. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I have to say, I grew up believing that the people who were making it were better than us.
Mm.
I didn't know why or how or what.
Mm-hmm.
But I believed it to such a degree that, you know, I thought that people who had nice hair, I thought that was an innate talent.
Ah, mm-hmm.
And no matter what I did, I couldn't make my hair look like the people who were making it.
That's right.
And, of course, now I know it was because my shampoo was a pump-up powder in gas stations along the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And my hairstylist was my cousin Wanda, who never had a lesson.
Right.
You know, and I was made fun of for my clothes, so I thought, I don't know how to dress.
Right, right.
You, Paulo Freire labels it internalized deficiency,
mm-hmm.
or that... And it really does take away that sense of hope. And without hope, and that's really what Poverty Bridge is working to do,
mm-hmm.
restore the hope by showing people their strengths,
mm-hmm.
and helping them to have a deeper understanding of real causes of poverty.
Mm-hmm.
I think one interesting thing is that a lot of folks believe you have to go abroad to fight poverty.
Mm.
It's such an unspoken issue. Matter of fact, I met a couple guys from Poland and from Russia who told me, there's no poverty in America. When I told them what I do, I fight poverty issues, they said, well, you must not be very busy.
Right.
There's
oh.
no poverty in America. And I'm like, sit down, guys. So I started
giving
them
right.
some of the facts.
Right.
60% of Americans earn less than $14 an hour,
mm.
which is, if you look at the federal living wage, not minimum wage, but the federal living wage, 60% of Americans earn less than a living wage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people say, well, maybe people should get married. That'll solve poverty. And I say, who you think we're going to marry?
Right.
We're isolated. We're
right.
segregated.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I married, surprise, surprise, somebody from a generational migrant labor family.
Mm-hmm.
How'd I find him?
Mm-hmm.
I used to think that about housing. How is it that no matter what town we go into, we find the ghetto?
Right.
How do we do that? We don't have maps.
Mm-hmm.
I know now that those are the only landlords that would rent to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know now that when someone says to me, why do you have these knowledge gaps? Why didn't you know what continent you lived on until you were 30
mm-hmm.
and you traveled to Europe? Back then, I would think, I must be dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Now I say, you ever heard of Maslow?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's difficult to learn when you're not safe.
That's
so
right.
folks who are struggling in that crisis condition of poverty, we have to see it as a war zone.
Mm-hmm.
If you look historically, the metaphor of war is woven throughout the literature of poverty, because that is what it feels like. When you watch people you love not well taken care of,
mm-hmm.
one of my brothers, every one of his teeth, I have super glue on them. That's
mm.
how he makes his teeth stop hurting.
Wow.
All five of my brothers have been incarcerated. I'm actually the only family member not incarcerated.
Mm.
And it's not because I didn't break the law.
Mm-hmm.
Poverty doesn't always allow you to be good.
That's right.
And it doesn't make it right. But as a public, when we begin to understand the why behind some of those behaviors, we can build in solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm addicted to methamphetamines, what is our nation's answer to meth for people in poverty?
Jail. That's right.
Anybody think jail going to cure meth?
No.
You know? And if we do have programs, they're typically, I've found across the nation, 5 to 30 days long.
Mm-hmm.
They have a 9-month average wait list. So if I'm lucky enough to get in, let's say I get 30 days, I go through the meth rehab program, what do you think is going to happen when I get out?
You got to go back and live in the same environment you lived in before.
I'm going right back to it because the literature is pretty clear. It takes a year of intensive rehab. Now, Clackamas County, for its third year, is doing a year-long meth rehab program, and it's working. Wow. They're actually doing what the research says. So, but what we say to people is, you didn't love your family. Mm-hmm. You didn't really want a better life. We don't say, wow, we didn't really set you up for success. Mm-hmm. Other thing I want to mention is I am part of a documentary called Invisible Nation. And if you go to my website, I have Communication Across Barriers, which is my consulting company. So the website is combarriers.com, combarriers.com. If you scroll down to Invisible Nation, there's a 10-minute preview of an upcoming documentary that's going to be shown on PBS.
Mm-hmm. It's very compelling. It's just, I strongly encourage people to take 10 minutes out and watch it because it captures so much of what we've been talking about this hour.
It does. And the executive producer is a 5-time Emmy Award-winning producer from New York. His name's George Rivera. He grew up in Harlem. Mm. And so he gets poverty at such a deep level. So in that 10-minute preview that was actually funded by Al Jubitz, he's able to capture some of the essence of the issues that we need to address to really help people to move forward.
Wow. Well, you know, one question I had was how you're going to be dealing with this in these conferences. My own family experience with poverty, I spent a good portion of my childhood, we were on welfare, and we had a period of homelessness and all. And one of my primary responses was anger and, you know, viewing those in better shape than I am to as, you know.
The enemy, huh?
The enemy. And, you know, I mean, I was fortunate. I managed not to take that to the extremes that ended up where I was learning how to make license plates.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sure, as you know, anger is something that just is burning all the time. And, you know, how are you helping people figure out how to recognize that anger, how to deal with it, how to channel it in ways that are going to be constructive rather than destructive?
Well, first off, you have to validate that the experiences, that pain is real. Mm-hmm. My brother Melvin married a woman with 3 kids who was on welfare and diabetic. He was working minimum wage tire job. When they got married, she lost her medical card. She ended up reusing needles, running out of insulin, had a massive heart attack, paralyzed on one side of her body. My brother came to me with tears in his eyes. He said, Donna, I got to get a divorce because it's the only damn way I can get her health care. So they divorced and began living together. They lived in Washington State, which has a step-parent law that says if you marry somebody with children, you're liable till they're 18. So he then began getting billings from the state for child support for the 3 children. They garnished his minimum wage job. He lost his job. They got evicted from their apartment. Why is he so angry?
Right.
Yeah. He shows up to apply for a job, and he's 50 years old, and the boss tells him, you know, we are looking for someone a little younger.
Right.
And
right.
My brother tells me, Donna, I told him, you know, you can't say that. That ain't legal.
That's right.
And I'm listening to my brother, and I'm thinking, where's your voice?
Right. That's right.
You know, who can hear you? You have no teeth.
Right.
You say ain't every other word. We have to get involved in our communities. That's the role of the navigator in our opportunity conferences. That's the role that any citizen who wants to make a difference can play. And again, it's simply looking at your hands and saying, what can I do? Is there something I can do? And it's not about this, you know, the concept people fear enabling. I don't want to enable.
Mm-hmm.
I call the definition of enabling excuse for not helping.
Ah.
It's
a way to separate yourself, right?
That's right. Because if you look at Maslow, he taught you can't enable somebody without their fundamental human needs met.
That's right.
That doesn't mean you do everything for me, but do it with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, navigate me through this foreign land. Mm-hmm. Help me see what possibilities are there. Help me have the language to ask the kinds of questions that I need to ask to really truly develop my potential. Can you imagine a world where all of our citizens are developing to their potential?
Mm.
That's the society I want to live in.
You and me both. And so Donna needs 48 more navigators for this program that's coming up on March 7th. And Donna, I want to volunteer to be a navigator. When I talked to your person, I said, I don't have time to do this. You know, it sounds great, but where am I going to find the time? But I will find the time to support this
Yay.
Effort.
It's what, a 6-month commitment?
Yes.
And you estimate about, what, 12 hours a month?
Yes.
Which seems pretty...
which seems doable. Of course, on my schedule, that means that's insanity. But I can add 12 more hours because this is so critical that people know, A, that other people care, right?
That's right.
And you don't have to know people to care about what happens to them. And
I also want to say we do provide a training for the navigators. On March 2nd, we will provide a Poverty 101 and Communication Skills training. It's a four-hour training from 4 to 8. It is only open to those folks who sign up and say, I will be a navigator. Mm-hmm. Because I work as hard to set the folks who are in the Opportunity Conference up for success with the navigators. I don't want them to walk into a connection where they feel like they're not clear of how to understand how to get to the perspectives of the folks that they're working
That's
with.
Right.
So I set them up for the same kinds of success.
Wonderful.
Now, Poverty Bridge is also doing other things obviously these conferences are very important, but there are other aspects of the organization, other operations you're doing?
We do. We have the Authentic Voices Institute, which is a 9-month institute where we take people who've lived poverty. The first part of the curriculum works on confidence. The second part works on communication skills. How do I walk into a room full of people who speak middle-class language? And mm-hmm. by the way, I am bilingual. I speak fluent middle-class language. I speak the vocabulary.
And without an accent, I've noticed.
But what's fascinating is that when I'm tired, my grammar reverts.
Uh-huh.
Just as, and I was really privileged to have a professor at University of Portland, Dr. Bob Fulford, who was a language specialist, and he taught me, you need to learn a second language. You don't need nouns, adjectives, and verbs. You need to speak with somebody who speaks middle-class sentence structure, mm-hmm. middle-class vocabulary. Mm-hmm. And so I had that privilege. So I work with people to help them get that. But we do have 4 information sessions coming up for navigators. If your interest has peaked but you're not quite sure and you want to come mm-hmm. and hear more about what does it mean to be a navigator or what other volunteer opportunities are available, you can go to our website. We have one on February 10th, February 12th, February 19th. And February 24th. And the locations are on the website for povertybridge.org.
Excellent. Well, Donna, I have to say this has been an incredible program, and I really, really thank you not just for being here, but for doing the incredible work that you've done.
You too.
And what I know about you is, you know, once you got your education, you could have gone off and, you know, went into some corporate boardroom and made big money and sat back and just enjoyed life. But it's so wonderful to know that you went. I'm tearing up. Tough broad like me, tearing up. I'm talking about this stuff. But just want you to know how much it's appreciated.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I, like you, Joanne, know too much to be quiet.
That's right. That's right. We've been talking to Donna Beagle.
Yes.
Check her out on povertybridge.org. And I'm Joanne Bowman.
And I'm Dave Mazza.
And this has been Voices from the Edge. And we will see you next week, same time, same place, same channel. Hope you have a fabulous day. Actually, it looks like we've got like another minute or so.
I know. You're rushing to get out of here.
It's because I'm tearing up, and I don't want people to think this tough broad is just like, you know, slobbering.
It's all a front, folks. It's all a front.
So let's see. What else should we talk about?
Well, we did want to make a brief mention about our police bureau doing fine job of taking care of intoxicated people.
Yes, yes, yes.
As some folks may have read in the Oregonian yesterday, a young African-American woman who came home late from a party to her apartment in Northwest Portland was assaulted by 3 police officers who did not want to bother to read her name on the address board.
That's right.
Instead, they tasered her, and
yes.
she had to go to the hospital. So,
and if you saw the Oregonian yesterday, you also know that the jail refused to take her until she had medical treatment. Is that the kind of treatment that we want to see community members get from our police department? I would say not.
So we encourage folks to let Chief Rosie Sizer know how you feel about this and the approach they're taking towards citizens and what, of course, is what they refuse to admit is racial profiling, obviously.
And, of course, the new police commissioner, Commissioner Dan Saltzman, also needs to hear from you.
Good point. Good
Thank
point.
You very much. Have a great day.
Take care now.
Stand up for your rights. Come on. Get up. Stand up. Stand up for